You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard, and Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas, everyone. It's nearly Christmas.
It's a little bit early for that, Lionel, is it not? I mean, we'll get to that, will we not? We're not building towards that in this podcast.
How do they celebrate Christmas in Watford, Lionel? Any traditions particular to Watford?
I'm finding some roadkill. Try and avoid just a
goose. Is it goose for you this Christmas, Lionel, or are you not posh enough for that?
No, it won't be goose. It'll be turkey. Yeah, I don't just get me started talking about Christmas dinner 5 or 6 days too early. I'll be hungry for a week.
I didn't tell you guys about this. I got a complaint from a listener about too much food chat, too much cassoulet chat.
Well, in that case, don't tune in then next week for our cassoulet episode. Is what I would.
Yeah,
I would
know. It should have been discussed in our board meeting. Really, shouldn't it?
It should. I've actually left the turkey ordering too late, and so I don't know what we're going to be since I tried to order my turkey yesterday and was told it was too late. I haven't actually mentioned that at home yet, but we'll deal with that. This is our final regular podcast, isn't it? Not only before Christmas, but of the year. Is that not correct, Lionel?
I think that is correct. It's although we will have a sort of a montage-y review of the year-y type thing that will go out between Christmas and New Year. So everyone can look forward to our highlights and lowlights.
A whimsical flaneuring review of the year.
Well, I haven't heard it yet, so I don't know what's in it. So it's going to be it'll be like a opening a Christmas present. It'll be a surprise for everyone.
Well, we've had to reshuffle the pack a little bit, haven't we, with this Chris Froome news, which has consumed us all for the last week or so, and our plans went a little bit awry. We do have, I mentioned already, the cassoulet episode. That was a dinner, myself, you, Lionel, Hayden Groves, the chef, and Orla Shinawee. That was a fun evening, and we made that as a podcast. We'll hear a clip from that in this week's episode, but that will go out, the full dinner will go out as a Friends special. Well, it'll be a bonus episode for Friends of the Podcast, so thank you everyone who's signed up as a friend of the podcast already. TheCyclingPodcast.com, you will be able to hear that there. We'll put that out next week in between Christmas and New Year. Perfect when you're digesting your turkeys or whatever it is you've eaten. We don't have a news roundup this week, do we, Lionel? We're just freewheeling a bit.
It's too early in the morning. You've got me up quite early today for
No news, good news.
Not sure I'd go that far. It has been a week dominated by the continuing fallout from a week ago, the news that Chris Froome had returned an adverse analytical finding from the Vuelta for salbutamol. We talked about this at length last week. We're going to talk about it again today. I'm not sure that there's much really to add. There's still a lot of confusion about what such a raised level of that salbutamol was doing in Chris Froome's urine on the particular day. Have we got any further with that, Daniel? You've been very good on Twitter, I notice, and tweeting out facts and things like that. You've been looking into
that'll
this.
Never
particular...
catch on. No, I'll never catch on.
Breaking.
Yeah, I know, but
very unlike us as well. I might have even got the odd thing right.
I mean, yeah, one or two things. But you've been looking into this pretty closely, haven't you?
Yeah, there's been a bit of clarification on a few things. We talked last week about this issue of the provisional suspension and whether Chris Froome could have voluntarily taken a provisional suspension, which then further down the line, should he get a ban, would actually be to his advantage, because then he would have, the provisional suspension would count as, they call it credit in the UCI regulations, against any eventual ban. So effectively, if Chris Froome had suspended himself when the test happened or when he got the result through, so in late September, he would already be 3 months into or 2 months into a provisional ban, and you know, should he get, or were he to get, a 3-month ban eventually when the sanction is announced, then he would already have those 2 or 3 months in credit, and he would be able to come back to racing straight away. And I think there's been a bit of confusion about this, and the UCI have clarified that, and they put out a press release this week, which I thought was very useful and pretty good of them to do, because all sorts of speculation. And also, we know that Chris Froome hasn't voluntarily taken a provisional suspension, which I think indicates that Sky are very confident, or were very confident initially. They might be slightly less confident now. I think probably the fact that this has leaked out into the public domain and people are starting to speculate probably doesn't help the cause, because the pressure is increasing, I think, on whoever is eventually going to make the decision, the key decisions, not to be showing any favouritism towards Sky. And we had this statement from Tony Martin last week, where Tony Martin actually got the rules slightly wrong, about, you know, should a provisional suspension have been mandatory in this case. It shouldn't, actually, according to the letter of the law. But what that statement from Tony Martin did reflect was a sort of a growing kind of lassitude, a growing sort of tiredness with some kind of perceived favoritism towards Sky, which, you know, it might simply be putting two and two together, that previously we had a UCI president who was British, Brian Cookson, used to be the British cycling president, and then a team Sky winning the big races. And, you know, a lot of people perceived that there was some kind of bias towards Sky. Whether there was or not, we don't know. But yeah, I thought that was quite significant. Tony Martin, of course, has now corrected that statement, and he's got the rules right. Just one other thing, Rich, was talking to some people yesterday in labs, and people who work in anti-doping, about this issue of dehydration. Could that be an argument for Chris Froome having so much of this, the salbutamol in his urine on the day he took the test? Because that's something that's been cited before unsuccessfully in cases by people like Alessandro Pataki. He said that he was dehydrated when he returned a positive sample. That was ultimately kicked out by the Court of Arbitration for Sport, not accepted as an excuse. But there have been studies that have shown that dehydration could affect the test result, and it could skew the test result and make it look as though there's more salbutamol, or you know, exaggerate the reading. WADA have never previously taken this into account. Up until a week ago, or 2 weeks ago, or a month ago, sorry, November 15th, dates, I'm not very good on dates. When they put out, they kind of sneaked out this document, a new technical document about the interpretation of test results for next year. And from next year, there is going to be a slight sort of statistical correction. If we talked last week about urine gravity, not an area that I wanted to get into, but basically it's the sort of density of urine, and it's an indicator of dehydration. So if a rider now is perceived to be dehydrated, or his urine sample reflects that he's dehydrated, now there will be this slight correction made, which will effectively bring the kind of net salbutamol level down. And although this only is supposed to come into force next year, I'm told that as soon as these documents are released by WADA, the labs are at liberty, if it's in favour of the athlete, to apply the new standards. So it could conceivably be a factor in this Froome case. However, we know that his reading was extremely high, 2,000 nanograms per milliliter. And I'm pretty sure that the correction would not bring it down to the legal limit. However, one could say that it will bring it closer to that, and it will bring Sky and Froome and his legal team down to a position that's easier to argue from. You know, if his corrected level is only just over the legal limit.
I mean, a few things there. The whole point about the provisional ban, I wondered if that would be seen as an admission of guilt, and could prejudice his case, or certainly in Froome's eyes. And then if the case is unresolved, can you lift your own provisional ban? You know, can you return to racing and still have 4 months credit, as it were? I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, all we've had over the last week really is a lot of reaction to the news of the adverse analytical finding, or positive test, as some people are calling it. It's been interesting, because what's been very difficult, and I thought Richard Williams and William Fotheringham in The Guardian over the weekend wrote this very well, is that nobody I think there are two things here. Sky themselves, as you say, Daniel, Sky seem to be very confident that they will be able to explain this and Chris Froome will be cleared. But they seem to be looking at this case in isolation and judging it entirely on its merits or otherwise. The wider public and the media and so on are not. The wider public are looking at a pattern of events concerning Team Sky over the last 12 months or so. And it fits a wider narrative that has already been decided upon by people. That shouldn't happen. This case should be looked at in isolation and not in the context of all these other episodes and concerning TUEs for Bradley Wiggins, Jiffy Bags, etc. And, you know, talk about grey areas and all the rest of it. It really should be looked at in isolation, but of course it won't be. And it does fit that narrative. And as we discussed last week, I mean, actually, before I go on to that, another story just last few days concerning the American sprinter Justin Gatlin is similar in a way, in that it came out that, you know, his coach and agent had been implicated in offering people doping products. It fit with a wider narrative that Gatlin has twice tested positive, and
Linus Cat's not a big fan of Justin Gatlin.
Justin Catlin.
Really?
And yet, as the dust settles on that story, it doesn't look like Gatlin is directly implicated in this at all. But the damage is done, and so with Froome, it almost, and certainly from the wider point of view, the wider public point of view, it almost doesn't matter what the facts are of this case. It fits with that wider narrative, and the damage, whatever happens, that the damage is done.
Well, the pattern of is unavoidable, Rich, isn't it? Because one of the things about the TUE, Bradley Wiggins TUE case that was revealed by the Fancy Bears hackers last year, and one of the things about this case was that I get the impression that there was a confidence that these events wouldn't find their way into the public domain, and of course they have done. Now, you know, if we imagine a completely different set of events with Chris Froome, he's been asked to explain this adverse analytical finding, and the UCI has the capacity to carry out all of these proceedings behind closed doors, without damaging Chris Froome's reputation in the way that has undoubtedly happened in the last week. They're in a parallel universe. It's quite easy to imagine that if the lawyers and scientists who are going to fight Chris Froome's case were successful, and they successfully argued that there shouldn't be any kind of action taken as a result of this adverse analytical finding, this may not have emerged into the public domain. And I think the thing that's most staggering to me, Rich, is that you and Orla went down to see the Froomes, mid-October? So, 3 weeks after they learned this news? 3 weeks, presumably, into the process of gathering evidence and information and providing that evidence and information. And then, after that, the whole deal to take Chris Froome to the Giro d'Italia was announced with quite some fanfare while all of this was going on in the background, and that to me seems to strike a slightly arrogant note that I'm afraid you can't avoid when talking about Team Sky and these incidents that do seem to come up at fairly regular intervals.
I'm staggered that all went on, those negotiations with RCS, and the announcement that Chris Froome made that he was riding the Giro while this was still unresolved. I'm staggered at that, and I think, as you say, Lionel, as you reflect on that now, it looks really bad. And you know, Team Sky things have come out before, the things have been leaked to the press before. Remember Froome's TUE and the Tour de Romandie in 2014. Which generated lots of very, very negative headlines. The Fancy Bears, of course, of Bradley Wiggins. And now this is a leak as well. So, you know, things have tended to come out. And the assumption that it wouldn't has obviously been had, or been something that was felt at Team Sky. And they thought they could quietly deal with this and move on. And yeah, with it coming out and you know, piecing together events of the last month or so, and the Giro negotiation announcement in particular,
it does look really bad, and it's another PR disaster for Team Sky. I was thinking about this in relation not to anything regarding you know, alleged doping or anything else, but you know, for Team Sky, and we've said this many times, performance is first. Everything else is a very distant second, and there is a perception that Sky are very interested and keen on PR and marketing and so on. And they really aren't. You know, they really are not. I mean, look at the Gianni Moscon case this year with the racist incident at the Tour de Romandie. You know, that was handled every step that was handled badly by Team Sky. He wasn't sent home from the race. His punishment was kind of meaningless. He was put on a diversity warning course that we never heard anything about ever again. And at the end of the year, he was named Young Rider of the Year by Team Sky. You know, there didn't seem to be much. They don't really care that looked bad. I mean,
no, I think, Rich, the whole concept now of marginal gains has been completely scoffed at and thrown out and scorned. But you know, I would still suggest that it was definitely a thing, but it was very limited in its scope and very limited in its vision. And you know, if you think of a sort of a pyramid of priorities for Sky, it's really a bottomless pyramid, and there's only, you know, only one thing has ever mattered. You know, press conferences that were organized very, very inconvenient for the press. And you know, why was that done? I remember one in Po in what year was it, 2012, where the Team Sky was staying about 200 meters from the press room, and in a terrible setting for a press conference. And you know, we asked them why didn't they go to the press room to do it, which was a perfect environment, and they said, well, we couldn't have the riders walking 200 meters. And you know, that to me was indicative of how little they sort of knew and acknowledged about, you know, other aspects of, you know, the Tour de France, and that besides the performance of their riders.
The DNA of the team is the British Olympic program, and it does come from that. It's hardwired, I think, in Dave Brailsford to be judged on performance alone, and that's what happens at the Olympic Games. Every 4 years, you're judged on whether you win medals or not, and that's it. There's nothing else. There's none of the other things that come along with professional sport, like image and PR and so on. And that does seem to have been hardwired into the team from day one.
And I think, you know, that is fine in, you know, this kind of single-minded approach is you know, lauded in some and criticised in others. So, I mean, it's a bit of a strange thing to criticise a sports team for being absolutely single-minded about trying to win. But I do think that, you know, cycling is a, you know, the peloton is a sort of society on wheels, really. It relies on an awful lot of kind of respect and trust you know, consideration for other people out on the road, because, you know, everyone's riding very close to each other and all of that. You know, there isn't a kind of, you know, the thing of we crush everyone else under our wheels is, you know, within a kind of accepted reason. I think this case and some of the others in the past, there's just a kind of a lack of respect for things and other people that just comes through. And the Moscon case is a very, very obvious example of that. But also in this case, you know, using the Giro d'Italia, a race with 100 years of history, over 100 years of history, 100 editions behind it, and kind of not having the respect for the race, knowing that this would come out and it might come out and hang over the entire event for the next 5 or 6 months. The respect for other competitors and other competitors who, you know, will be making their plans for next year. Now, I know maybe that shouldn't register on Sky's radar and they should just carry on and do what they think is best for them, but it's quite a sort of wearisome
strand
to their DNA.
Here we are, you know, doing exactly what I said we shouldn't do, but of course we will do, and everybody will do it. We've broadened the discussion from Chris Froome's case to a much wider one. And that's the problem that Froome has, and it's the problem that Sky has now, because it's very, very hard to look at this case in isolation. It has become, you know, certainly in the media and among fans of cycling, part of a much wider discussion around Team Sky.
Daniel's made the point very strongly and very clearly that, you know, really all of this, you know, all of this, everything I've just said, everything we're kind of saying about the perception and what may or may not happen is largely, well, almost entirely hot air, isn't it? It's just an opinion and a feeling and what have you. Really, all that will actually matter is the verdict from the UCI, what happens with Chris Froome, whether he is suspended or whether he is not suspended. That really is the only thing. But until we have that answer, inevitably the vacuum is going to be filled by all of this kind of, because this is what, you know, this is what people watching the sport will be thinking. If when Chris Froome returns to racing in the new year, if he does so before a decision has been made, which at the moment he's perfectly entitled to do, there's going to be so much focus on this, and it's going to be detrimental to, you know, the image of cycling, really. And that's something that the UCI needs to consider and get to grips with quickly as well.
Yeah, and Lionel, just you know, on that point about their sort of tunnel vision and you know, the marginal gains or how focused that they are on attention or how much attention to detail they show. I mean, that was purely to say that now the attention to detail will shift to this case, because this case is fundamental to their ultimate goal of winning big races. So, you know, you can bet your bottom dollar that if they've been slightly sort of nonchalant and not shown enough attention to you know, something of this nature before, then in this case they certainly will. And, you know, I think that maybe explains the difference in treatment between, well, the way they treated sort of Sergio Henao when he was provisionally suspended, or by the team when his blood values were a little bit off, and then we've never seen the study into his blood values, and now Chris Froome, who they haven't suspended, and you can be sure they'll be mobilizing absolutely all of their forces to try and clear. Just another short factual footnote, Rich. You talked about, you know, the issue of whether this was ever going to get out and whether Sky thought it was ever going to get out, and also the likelihood or the possibility that there have been numerous other cases with this substance, salbutamol, where riders have successfully argued with the UCI and been cleared without the public knowing. I think that there have been. I mean, I think Sky perhaps think there have been a few of those cases that we have not found out about, but I don't think it's a very frequent occurrence. I mean, I was just going through the Pataki case again, and one of the witnesses there, it was Dr. Francesco Botre of the Rome laboratory, and he said in that case that he'd in 9 years at the Rome laboratory, the WADA accredited Rome laboratory, he'd checked 60 or 70,000 samples for salbutamol, and he'd had 5 or 6 samples where there was a concentration of more than the 1,000 nanograms per milliliter limit.
Just lastly, Daniel, you make a very good point there about the issue of medical records, and without being unfair and without you know, being overly sort of cynical about it, I can quite understand, you know, listeners to the podcast, fans of cycling, fans of Team Sky, being quite perplexed about the fact that, you know, a year ago we had the Bradley Wiggins TUE case, which effectively in the end hinged on missing medical records, poorly kept medical records. And here we are, you know, a little more than a year on, and we have a case where we can only assume Team Sky will be doing absolutely everything to, you know, present every single medical record they have to support their case. And you know, that kind of, you know, there's a sort of public perception to that as well. You know, in one case say the records went missing, and in one case perhaps the records are entirely complete, and you could say, well, they've improved their record keeping, as Dave Brailsford said that they would, and on the other hand, you know, the cynics could quite easily say, well, they went missing when they had to, and they were available when they needed to be.
Whoever you are, whatever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Well, that was a very festive opening part to the podcast, wasn't it? I'm feeling a mood for a mince pie now, Rich.
Well, before we press on with Daniel's trip to the cyclocross, which I'm really looking forward to hearing, we should say a big thanks to Rafa for sponsoring the podcast. And our range of Rafa clothing and Peddler de Charme t-shirts and jerseys are available at If you go to shop at thecyclingpodcast.com, that'll take you to our page on the RAFA website. I should clarify, Pédaleuse de Charme have been saying for weeks that they are imminent. They have been held up, unfortunately, out with our control. They will be available, I've been told to say, in the first week in February. They'll definitely be available then. I hope they'll be available before then, but they'll definitely be available for then. So I'm sorry they're not available for Christmas, as we promised. Big apology for that. But they will be coming soon.
Just to inject some festive cheer, and also on our sponsors, Rafa, the Festive 500, which is Rafa's annual challenge to get people to ride 500 kilometres between Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. I've been sort of volunteered to have a go at this. I already know.
You've been flirting with it, haven't you, Lionel?
500 kilometres. Well, unless indoor kilometres count. I haven't had a ruling on that yet. I'm awaiting that. Somebody might be able to tell me whether indoor kilometres count. I've got too much eating and drinking to do between Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. There's just not enough time for cycling.
No. I'm curious to see whether Daniel will actually beat you running, whether he'll cover more kilometres running than you will on a bike.
Well, maybe that's the challenge. Maybe, can I, yeah, okay. Daniel, are you...
What are you aiming for, Napalm? What sort of ballpark figure? I reckon...
Well, I don't know.
In a week, you'll need to... I'm going to aim for about 150, 200 kilometres. No, that's too much. What am I talking? That's too much. 100 kilometres and I'll beat you. Anyway.
You still may beat me. I mean, the weather, for me, the weather's a big factor. I'm too soft for winter cycling.
I'll try and walk 5,000 steps a day. That'll be my little contribution to this.
That's basically a sedentary lifestyle, really.
It is. I don't plan on leaving the house, obviously. But listen, let's crack on and do something quite festive, or listen to something quite festive. Daniel, you donned your yellow tracksuit and your Wellington boots and went and took to the countryside at the weekend, I understand.
Shocking it was. It was shocking, a culture shock in so many different ways. Cyclocross, my first ever experience of cyclocross. What more should I really add before we actually hear from my adventures in Belgium?
Well, where was it and what was the competition? That would be a
Skeldercross, Lionel. Skeldercross, which to my dismay had nothing to do, bore no relation to Skelder Price, the sort of late spring classic, traditionally won by a sprinter. Well, it doesn't have anything to do with that or nothing in common except the fact that it also takes place in Antwerp, Skelder being the river that runs through Antwerp. But we were there. We weren't just there. It wasn't just a whimsical jaunt, Rich. We were entering into a bit of a partnership, aren't we, with a new organisation team called Mudita. And this is something that Matt Brammeyer, who's a pro at Aqua Blue, and his wife, Nikki Brammeyer, have set up. Basically, it's going to be a new team for Nikki from the 1st of January. But it's not just a team, it's a project. Matt's a very, very dynamic young chap. He's a bit like you, Rich, a bit of a buffalo in that he sort of has these plans and he tends to execute them, whereas the rest of us tend to sort of flanner and flounce around and just make empty promises. But yeah, Matt has he's set up a fantastic kit appeal for where he's collected a lot of secondhand kit and sent it to Africa. And then now he and Nikki are behind this project, which seeks to really raise the profile of cyclocross in the UK. And part of this project is going to be a podcast in conjunction with us. It's going to be a bit of a trial this year and we'll see how this goes down, my package first of all. But we are going to be at the World Championships in Valkenburg at the start of February. We're going to do a big preview. We're going to be in Valkenburg and then we're going to do a review show as well, and that's going to be called the Cyclocross Podcast, not to be confused with the Cycling Podcast, but you know, related
sister, a new sister.
Yeah. But it did shock me, the old cyclocross. The pitch was terrible. I couldn't believe how bad the pitch was. They could barely ride their bikes at certain points. They were getting off their bikes and running, which was, you know, it was a bit, which seems to me a bit of a farce, but I'm told that that's just what they do in cyclocross. At least it was outdoors.
Par for the course, I'm led to believe. Shall we? Without further ado, should we hear it?
Should we go?
Cross to Belgium.
Let's cross to Belgium. Guy Vermeeren, a very long-serving member of the Belgian cycling press pack. I'm going to ask you a very simple question, Guy. I'm going to ask you to sell cyclocross to a novice like me and answer the question of cyclocross, why?
It's a perfect television sport. I mean, you have 60 minutes packed with action. If you ask me, it's the television sport in cycling.
And why has the rest of the world not discovered this yet?
Good question. I don't know.
Well, Berlin, I knew that people didn't come to cyclocross for the music, and I've had that confirmed to me. Where are we now? Just explain to me the scene that we're surveying at the moment.
So we are in front of one of the big beer tents at the race here in Antwerp, and it's a huge wide tent with a DJ in one corner and a beer tap in the other corner, and people first buy some beers and then they just enjoy the drink and the brilliant music.
You'd have to be enjoying a lot of drink to enjoy this music, I think. So I'm here with three titans of the what's going to be the cyclocross podcast. Renard Schotter, a veteran reporter on cyclocross and cycling in general from Belgium, very important when we're talking about cyclocross. Also got Belint Hamvas here, who is the leading cyclocross photographer in the world at the moment. And also been graced by Matt Brammeyer, who is the partner, you're married now in fact, aren't you Matt, to Nikki Brammeyer, who's one of the leading women cyclocross riders and a road rider, road professional in your own right. Now guys, I'm going to get straight into the detail, nitty gritty of this season as we look forward to Valkenburg. I mean, Renard, what have been the big themes for you so far this year? What surprised you so far about the cyclocross season?
But the supremacy of Van der Poel is quite unseen, because we would have expected a close duel between him and Wout van Aert. But up until now, Mathieu has basically dominated the season. So it's going to be interesting to see if in the remainder of the season Van Aert is able to cope with the dominance of Van der Poel. And it would be nice actually to have that duel during the World Championships. And everybody kind of hopes for a close battle. But up until now, Van der Poel, besides bad luck, has done whatever he wanted, basically. Mathieu and Wout are big riders, but they still don't have the personality that back in the days Nees and Wellens had. And as soon as we would reach that level, then it'll be intergalactic, I'm quite sure.
They need to start hating each other, don't they? As I understand it, their relationship at the moment is quite cordial.
Their relationship is okay. I think they could be friends. Wasn't for their sportive rivalry. I mean, they share a lot of things. They have common interests. Basically, they grew up really only a couple of K from each other. That also plays a role. And Mathieu isn't as Dutch as it says on his passport. He's Belgium. He's Antwerp. He's born here. He's born in Antwerp. He's raised in Antwerp. He watches Flemish TV. That's about Van Aert's youth. So they're really quite similar, and I think it could have been a different ball game if Mathieu would have been raised in the north of Holland and came from some faraway polder to conquer Belgian fields. Then the rivalry would have been more natural. But now they're peers.
Berlin, you've been covering cyclocross for a few years now. How far along are these two riders, Van der Poel and Van Aert, in terms of establishing a kind of legacy among the greats of the recent past of cyclocross? I mean, is it right already to class them in the same bracket as like a Sven Nys?
I think that's probably a bit too early, because they're just so young. And but then again, they've done things that, you know, probably Sven Nys, like they both won world championship titles while they were on technically under 23 categories. They just got special dispensation from the UCI. But I think they haven't got that stature just yet that like Sven Nys had. I think they will be distracted by the road side of things, and they will maybe even get bored by cyclocross, because they're not challenged here, and so I think the big danger is that they might just leave cross and go to the road.
And that's the theme, isn't it, in cyclocross? There's always been a theme. Is that ever going to change? That, you know, we've seen the likes of Stibar achieve a certain level of dominance in cyclocross and then move on, and, you know, it's likely to happen with both of these guys. Do you think that's ever going to change, Renard?
Well, it's different now. Stibar was let that be clear, was a great champion. But if you look at the talent, Wout and Mathieu are both sharing, then I think they're already playing in a different category, because Stibar was never able at the same age to do what those two guys have already done on the road. So I think they're more gifted, and in that way it's a different ball game. Will it ever change? It can change if the sport gets more popular worldwide, because that's a problem. It's basically, you know, the situation. It's big in Belgium. It's also quite big in Holland. But then as soon as you leave the Benelux, it's a problem. I think the Anglo-Saxon countries have a real chance there to pick up the sport. And I just hope and pray that Pidcock stays in cyclocross, and that British cycling sees that cyclocross has potential, and that it gets on British television and stuff like that. That would be awesome to make that leap. Maybe it's a quantum leap, but I just hope for it, because I'm quite sure with popularity bike racing these days has in the Anglo-Saxon part of the world, if they would have a champion like Pidcock, Pidcock now a youth champion, but if he becomes a pro champion, then I think the roof will be on fire.
You know, I'm maybe a little bit biased, but I think the women's racing has been better than the men's racing this year. There was a bit of a winning streak at the start of the year from Mouth Captains, and then, you know, Sanna's obviously, she's strong in most of the races, but you see it a lot in the women's events. You know, people have the ups and downs, and a lot of the time in cross, you know, it's horses for courses, and some people will be good at one race and then they'll be totally horrendous the next day. So yeah, if you ask me, it's been really exciting, and you know, the build up for the Worlds, I think is going to be even more immense and exciting.
And we're talking at Skeldercross, and it's we're midway through December, and this is where Marianne Vos is coming back. Is there always a slight concern, Matt? Look, Marianne Vos is going to explode again, and she's going to get back to the level of dominance that she once held?
Yeah, you know, of course it's like, it's natural to feel a little bit threatened by these girls coming back in, because they are, you know, the superstars of the sport. But we're happy, you know. It's like, it's got to be good. It has to be good for cyclocross, like, to have riders like Prevost and Vos coming back. And it's just like, it's a win-win situation for everyone, really. It just increases the value of the races and increases people watching, and yeah, there can't really be anything negative about it.
En met de hulp van een goede meneer, kan ook een mevrouw geweest zijn, daar aan de kant komt ze los, maar dan is Kant al los. En Kant komt helemaal los in de slotronde, trekt zich tot boven, maar ook Compton heeft enorm veel power. En Compton gaat zelfs nog eens over Sanne Kant.
Sanne, is a real battle there with Katie and Katarina on those last few laps. How did you approach it psychologically?
Yeah, the course was really fast, and we were with a small group, and we go with two in the last lap, and it was a nice battle with Katie. I just wait until the final 200 meters to go full gas, and I could take a few meters in a mud course, and I'm happy with the win.
So if you'll come back today, your first outing of the season in cyclocross, how do you think it went?
Went pretty good in the start, then pretty bad for one and a half lap or two, and then I got some rhythm back, and yeah, I found myself back in position 8-9, and I think that was the position I was in place today. So it was maybe not for the others, for all the people to what they expected, but for me it's not a big surprise. First time back, and I lacked the rhythm. I didn't have the best preparation health wise, but it's like it is, and cyclocross, it is hard, and I'm happy. I started the season, and I hope we can pick up the rhythm from now on.
And when you throw yourself back in like this, Marianne, is it more the technical skills that, or the technical rustiness that's the problem, or is it the physical?
Technical is a thing, because obviously that's also part of the routine. If you are more on the cyclocross bike, you feel more at ease on the bike. But I have to say that wasn't a problem today. I made some mistakes, but more because I was tired.
So retired to the secret lair of cyclocross's golden couple, the Brammeyers. Matt's here, Nicky's here. not really a Golden Cup because, Matt, you don't compete in cyclocross. However, Nicky's trying to game too.
I don't know if he's cut out for all the mud, to be honest.
First of all, Nicky, we've just watched you compete in Scheldecross tomorrow, a bigger race in Namur, but how did today go for you?
Yeah, I was happy with it. Like, Scheldecross is not really my favourite course. It's pretty fast and not that much mud, whereas tomorrow's hilly, proper technical, muddy, off cambers. Like, tomorrow I see as a real cross. So I'm quite happy with today. I was a little bit gutted because I had a flat tyre, so I lost the front group midway through the race. But then, it was okay. I was pretty happy and made some time up on the overall standings. So I'm still holding my second place for that. So, yeah, it was okay.
And this is an important period for you, isn't it? And there's more exciting news that you've got to announce, I think, or you will have announced in the last few days when people listen to this. You've got a new project that's starting on the 1st of January. Tell us about Mudita.
Okay, so Mudita is basically a project to try and help cyclocross grow in the UK. We've got a few different avenues that we've kind of been putting together behind the scenes, which is a pro team, a academy team, coaching, and basically just trying to get kids on bikes through doing some cross clinics in the UK. The aim is just to help cyclocross grow in the UK and provide a bit of a pathway for like the younger generation coming through the ranks, because I don't think there is one at the minute, and yeah, we just need to get people more involved in cyclocross.
Hier voor mij kwam bij het einde van de eerste ronde met de snelste ronde voor Lara Smith.
The women's race has just finished. We've seen Sanna Kant, who was the favourite and is the world champion. You see, I'm learning very fast. She was, I wouldn't say a convincing winner, but she won in a sprint. She was in a group with Katie Compton and Katarina Nash. And the men have just gone off, as you can hear. If you understand Flemish, that is.
Hier hebben we Van der Poel met Van der Haar, die daar nog wat wringt, maar daar uiteindelijk nog wel de bovenhand houdt. En dan gebeurt er wat. Er gebeurt net na de zwiep of voor de zwiep van de camera. Daar is Van der Poel wat blijven hangen.
Matthew, one area where people might think that Wout would be superior or your equal is running, and today you sort of turned the tables.
Yeah, I know my running is good for quite a while now. I did some regular running trainings now. The past years it was a bit difficult with my knee injury, but this year I run like once or twice a week maybe, and I feel that it makes a difference.
And was that move, that acceleration on the last lap, premeditated, or just you saw the moment and you went with your impulse?
Yeah, it was something I decided at that moment. I thought it was going to be a sprint, but then when I entered the descent, I had the good trace to follow, and then I decided to start my sprint a bit further away.
And your rivalry with Wout, you've been going at each other for so many years now, but we see you behind the podium and you still seem like you're pretty good friends. Is that the reality?
Yeah, friends maybe a lot said, but yeah, I mean, we need each other in cyclocross, and I think if you see how the audience reacted today, the spectators, it was really nice for both of us that there was a battle again.
Well, would it be fair to say that today you matched Mathieu on the bike, but you lost a running race on the last lap?
Yes, of course, the difference has been made on the running section and in the final part of the course. But I don't think I'm a bad runner, so I think he was just stronger when we jumped back on the bike, and he just had a little bit more left in his body than I had. I chose to stick in his wheel on the last lap because we had a long piece of headwind towards the finish line. But when you're 10 or 20 meters behind, you don't have the profit anymore of the wheel. So it was my tactic and not the best one in the end.
So we're back in the press room, back with Renard and Belin. Renard, we called you the expert for a reason, because you said today was going to be crucial in terms of reading how the rest of the season's going to go and reading sort of lie of the land before the World Championships. And you were absolutely right.
Yes, thank you.
as we've seen, it was one of the most tense races here today in Antwerp of the season, with a real battle. I mean, both had their share of bad luck with a mechanical and a crash, so it was even there. And then, as you can see, the race, the battle was really on. It was a duel, and I think everybody will make the conclusion that it was the first real duel of the season, because another factor was playing a part. So I think this is the start of the second part of the season with another story. I mean, Mathieu will still win his races. He's already at 19 at this point, but I'm quite sure that his victories will be more difficult from now on, especially on courses like we saw in Antwerp. So I think anything's there now for the moment. For the worlds, of course, it's still a long way. But I would say that Mathieu is still the main favourite to get that next rainbow jersey. But I think the edges are tighter now. And one of the main things that struck me today was that in the interview afterwards, Wout van Aert told the audience that he's lost weight during his training camp, and not a little bit of weight, but more than 2 kilos, which is really a lot in this phase of the season. So I think he's going to get an advantage of that in the remainder of the season.
And Belin, do you agree, a turning point in the season, or just a sort of glimmer of hope for Wout, which might be extinguished in the next few weeks?
I think in the last couple of weeks or months kind of showed that Mathieu very rarely holds back, if ever. So he goes for it, and depending on the day, he wins the race with like 5 seconds or 50.
So you guys think he was pushed very hard today?
I think he had to work hard for this win, and the fact that they were together up until the very final moment, I think that shows that Wout is probably now back on par with Mathieu, and hopefully this will be this. Yeah, as Renard said, this is the first kind of really exciting race this season, the first big duel. So hopefully this will mean that from now onwards they're going to see more of this.
Well, guys, it was definitely the most exciting cyclocross race that I've ever seen. The first one as well. But, yeah, let's hope we'll see more of the same in Valkenburg.
Excellent stuff, Daniel. That made me want to get back out to Belgium and go and watch a cross race myself. It's a few years now since I've been to any cyclocross.
Careful,
and I'm looking forward to going back to the World Championships.
Someone's got to go to Valkenburg.
Yeah, well, I'm well up for going to Valkenburg for the World Championships. The crosses that I've been to, the Koppenberg Cross is a great one, held in the fields and on the climb, the famous climb from the Tour of Flanders. And the one that I always like to go to, when you could dovetail it with the Ghent 6 track, you could do indoor and outdoor cycling on the same weekend, Daniel. I mean, you know, something for everyone. By going to the Coxeter World Cup. And that's also a course that's hosted the World Championships. And I once probably should drop in here that I think, unless I've been stripped of this honorary position, I'm the honorary UK president of the Sven Nys fan club. The excellent...
I think you've mentioned that, Lionel, on the podcast. I think you mentioned that more times than I've mentioned beating Justin Rose at golf.
Yeah, I think every time we mention cyclocross, you bring this up. Also that you once visited Andre van der Poel when his son was careering around the living room on a toy bike. Do I recall that correctly?
Well, thank you, Rich. They're my two cyclocross stories, which get a regular airing every winter. I can drop the mic now, can't I? Leave you two to it.
Well, I raced against Andre van der Poel, his father, as well, in Glasgow once. He won that race. Anyway, Mathieu van der Poel, we did hear from him there in that package of yours, Daniel. He is really the dominant force at the moment in men's cyclocross, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He's really dominated this year. And, you know, it's all set up for this classic duel between van der Poel and Van Aert. As we heard there, you know, they grew up a few kilometers from each other, similar age, similar talent, but it hasn't really flickered into life yet this year. But all sort of frivolity aside and facetiousness aside, one thing I did take from the cyclocross at the weekend was that this is a sport that really lends itself to duels, and it has a lot of what we wish we had in professional road cycling, i.e. direct confrontation on a very regular basis between the biggest names. And you know, in a very sort of neat, compact package of 1 hour, and as we heard Guy Vermeeren say there in the package, it's the perfect television sport. And you know, this duel between those two riders could develop into one for the ages. But you know, just speaking to a few people at the weekend, the attendances have been down this year, and there's a bit of a trend over the last few years since Sven Nys, a good friend of Lionel's, since he retired, he did absolutely dominate the sport, but he also sort of transcended the sport in terms of his public profile and personality. I mean, I must admit, I'm not really familiar with the reasons why he was considered, you know, such a charismatic figure, but he was, and he really sort of galvanized the tribal element of cyclocross, and that hasn't quite happened yet with these two riders, but it might do, and one would hope that it will happen before they respectively dedicate themselves to the road, which, you know, as we also talked about, is an inevitability.
One of the great things about it as a sport, and that you can watch a lot of it online, you know, that you can see the variety of different courses. It's going to test my knowledge here, but certainly, you know, there's coastal courses in Belgium. So, I mean, Coxeter, for example, is held in sand dunes. There's one a little bit further along the coast that actually kind of goes onto the beach. And,
well,
you know,
scaled across, Lionel, there was a bit of a section on the beach.
Does that do the same, does it?
It was a Lynx course. Oh. It was a Lynx course, Lionel. I'm surprised you don't know the proper terminology.
And then, of course, you've got, you know, weather conditions as well. You could have a muddy race on the same course. As you know, last year it could have been sort of frozen and firm, and so you get different courses suiting different riders. You know, there's a lot of variety to it, and the sort of the big competitions, the obviously the World Cup, the Super Prestige, and the competition that the Scheldt Cross is part of, which is it called the DVV Trophy these days? They're all slightly different. The World Cup and the Super Prestige are run on points for the overall competition, and I think the DVV, is it still run on time, where basically a sort of general classification race by race? Well, we're gonna discover all of this early next year, aren't we? When we go to Valkenburg for the World Championships and get under the skin of cyclocross a bit more, because one of the great things is. You know, I don't count myself as an expert. I count myself as a kind of keen enthusiast on cyclocross. So I'm looking forward to finding out a bit more about it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the difficulties of it is we talked there about the beach section, and you know, what do you call these things? I mean, I struggled with the vocabulary. I mean, I hope I was able to wing it to a sufficient degree. I hope it didn't come across too strongly to the riders there that I didn't know what I was talking about. You know, talking about the running section. I mean, is that like talking to a golfer about, like, you know, whirling a club instead of swinging a club? I don't know. I might have completely put my foot in it.
I think you got away with it, Daniel.
And you've been doing it for 15, 16 years in road cycling, so don't worry about it.
That's true.
Oh dear. So the Cyclocross podcast will be back with a sort of a week of three episodes, two or three.
I will have it sussed then, Lionel. We'll know everything by then. We'll be right on our game by the time the first week of February comes around.
I hope you don't alienate listeners with your knowledge. You know, you want to take the listeners on a journey with you. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are very keen on cyclocross, but perhaps more are in the same boat as me and keen to find out something about it.
Well, and Rich, we've made some fantastic signings. Renard Schotter, the voice of cyclocross, one of the voices of cyclocross in sports. You heard him there. So, some fantastic expressions there, some fantastic sort of metaphors. Talking about the rivalry between Van Aert and Van der Poel going into Galactic very soon, and the roof being on fire if Tom Pidcock, the British under 23 rider, develops as we think he's going to develop. So, you know, Renard was very excited and he got me excited.
Well, I can't wait. I'm so excited about this too now, having heard that, really. Before we take another little short pause, we're going to hear a little clip from an episode that in the original program was going to be played this week. But with the Froome news, we've rejigged things a bit. And our Cassoulet dinner, which was myself, Lionel Burney, Orla Shinawi and Hayden Groves, the chef, and took place at my house a couple of weeks ago and included a sort of review of the year. That will now be released as a bonus episode for Friends of the Podcast, so we'll release that between Christmas and New Year. We released this week Lunch with Luke. It's Lunch with Matt White, and that seems to have gone down well. Now, I should say, last week we played a clip from the Matt White episode, and it was maybe a little bit clunky, and one or two of you were confused because it began playing immediately after a segment discussing Froome. So we apologise if that created any confusion. It was a clip from the Friends special, which is available now. We're going to hear now a clip from the Cassoulet dinner. A reminder that Hayden's book, The Three Tours Cookbook, from which we all cooked recipes, and it was delicious, and he was a great guest. That is available, and all the proceeds are going to leukemia, Cure Leukemia, so look out for that. I was at the start of the next section, I'll tell you how you can buy that. But let's hear a little clip now from the Cassoulet dinner, which will be available next week as a bonus episode for Friends of the Podcast.
Cooking is pretty stressful when you know other people are going to be eating it. I mean, if you're cooking just for yourself.
Welcome to my world. You know what I mean? Welcome to my world. And it is, I mean, when you cook at home, and I think that's what the cookbook is all about. It's accessible recipes for the aspirational cook. It's not 3 days worth of mise en place, eight chefs behind you putting food on 50-pound plates. It's about just great food like we've enjoyed so far this evening. You know, no pressure for Orla with her tiramisu.
Orla. I'm going home now.
Yeah, oh, she's going home now.
Anybody can top up. Yeah, she will just get you drunk before you have the tiramisu.
She's going now, but she's just taking the takeaway portion of your cassoulet.
Orla's also just downgrade. Yeah. Well, she's flipped my 9 into a 6 for the starter.
I get overexcited about things. Like, and I was like, it's food that I haven't cooked and it's quite tasty, so I'll go for a 9. Wow. I hadn't had one single portion of cassoulet before tonight. I've now had 3. And I could keep going. It's amazing.
Become a friend of the podcast and get at least 11 exclusive in-depth episodes for just £15. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com to sign up for 2018.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. We are extremely grateful to them for their backing. Them and Rafa have been with us all year, and they've allowed us to produce all these free podcasts. I think about 135 odd free podcasts this year, which is a lot of listening. You can get 20% off your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code CPAUG20. Now, Hayden Groves is an ambassador for Science and Sport. And we heard a little bit from our dinner with him at the end of the last segment. You can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. It costs £15 for 2018. That's 3 episodes released already. This year we released, how many in the end? It was about 32 sort of episodes of varying lengths for Friends of the Podcast. So we commit to 11, but we will produce more than that. And thanks very much to everybody who's already signed up as a friend of the podcast. We've released At Home with the Froomes was the first one. That came out with great timing just before the Froome news. Then we did Lunch with Matt White and now the Cassoulet dinner, and lots more to come in the new year. We were going to talk in this final segment of the final regular podcast of 2017, do a bit of ramble, a bit of a roundup of what's going on in the world of cycling. I mean, we opened last week's podcast. I jokingly said the big news of the week was that Lotto NL Jumbo had sent home 3 riders for using non-approved sleeping medication. I was very flippant about it. There were 2 points to that. One is, had that been Team Sky, it would have been a very, very big story. But the second point is, it actually was quite a big story, and is quite a big story. I mean, Juan José Lobato has been sacked by the team, or left by mutual consent, I should say. And the 2 young Dutch riders involved have been suspended for 2 months. So a pretty serious affair, and pretty serious medication at the heart of it.
Right, what was Rich? The medication that these 3 riders supposedly used, well, I think it's been confirmed, was a name that was quite familiar to me, Stilnox. Not because I'm a frequent user of Stilnox, but because if people remember the Cofidis doping scandal, what became a bit of a doping scandal involving various drugs at the start of the noughties, well, I think it was 2004 actually, wasn't it? Stilnox figured prominently there, and it figured prominently in accounts by the late Frank Vandenbroek about his time at Cofidis. And it was a bit of an epidemic in the peloton back then, but it wasn't just being used as a sleeping remedy. It was being, the tablets I think were being crushed and snorted and supposedly produced a hallucinogenic effect or a euphoric effect. And it was very popular at that time, and it became a bit of a problem. We don't think that it is a problem on that scale anymore, but it certainly set some of my antenna buzzing when I heard the name Stilnox.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Cofidis. I mean, by all accounts, what they would do during sort of training camps, or team get-togethers, if they had a kind of a night on the beer or the wine, they'd take the sleeping tablets and then drink and then basically try and stay awake. And it's not a medication to be messed with, clearly. I mean, we don't know the circumstances fully, do we, yet, of what has happened at Lotto NL Jumbo, but
they did say alcohol, right, wasn't involved. They did clarify that, but
clearly, the team not happy with the riders dabbling with that particular medicine.
I must admit, I was quite surprised, and perhaps one of the most alarming aspects of this story was that one of the riders involved is a Neo Pro. Pascal Enkhorn, who's very promising Neo Pro. Well, he hasn't even made his debut yet, I don't think, unless he was a stagiaire last year, but this is his first full season for Lotto NL Jumbo. The other one is another young rider, Antoine Tolhoek, who had a terrible crash in the prologue, or the first stage of the Vuelta last year, the team time trial. And I remember we had a bit of a giggle back then because he came over the line and announced not only was he not going to do interviews that day, but he didn't do interviews.
Well, he's definitely not going to do them now, is he?
Yeah.
But I have to say, full marks to Lotto NL Jumbo for their transparency in this. It was a training camp. It could have all happened behind closed doors. And they've issued a statement about it. They've told people what was going on, and they've taken quite strong action. So, that's a team that emerged from the ashes of Rabobank, of course, clearly wanting to establish some ground rules and differentiate between the culture that's there now and what went on in the past.
Rich, you used the word culture, and just I've been speaking to a couple of riders since the weekend, and there is a feeling, whatever it's being used for, however it's being used, that there is a feeling that this is still a bit of a problem, sleeping pills being overused in the peloton. I've heard anecdotal reports in the last few days of certain team doctors sort of routinely going around riders' rooms before they go to bed and asking who wants a sleeping pill. And certainly, I think it's possibly quite nationalized or divided by nations. There are, in certain countries, I think that the culture is stronger than in others. And we talked about Cofidis earlier. I think it was a problem in France for a while. So, it's something that's from the outside.
I think in lots of sports as well, especially when athletes, cover time zones or travel over time zones and travel big distances. I mean, I remember I've told this story before about the England football team, certainly having a large quantities of uppers and downers, all legal, but sleeping pills, are commonly used, I think, by sports people because sleep is so important. And yet, as I understand it, sleep with sleeping pills isn't always quality sleep. So, well, fellas, I think we're drifting, meandering towards the end of the year, the end of the final regular podcast of the year. And before we go, I think we need to say Merry Christmas to everybody. Happy New Year when it comes. And thank you for listening throughout the year in record numbers. We've got a lot of new listeners this year, and we're very grateful to you for listening. And to a lot of you for signing up as friends of the podcast. Very, very grateful indeed. Thank you. Keeping us going and allowing us to make some very ambitious and exciting plans for next year, which we're looking forward to. But we do have some thank yous, don't we, Lionel, before we sign
We do.
Up.
Well, first of all, we have to thank our two title sponsors who have backed us all year. That's Rafa and Science in Sport. I'm incredibly grateful to them for their continued support of the cycling podcast. Very much, not just very much appreciated, but two great groups of people to work with as well.
Absolutely. We also had All Press Espresso at the Giro d'Italia sponsoring Kilometre Zero. And Niederberg Wines again at the Tour de France sponsoring Kilometre Zero for the second year. Thank you very much to them. Thanks also to Maserati for giving us a car to bumble around in at the Giro. That was a lot of fun. I'll say thanks to the contributors, our colleagues who've appeared on the podcast this year. Orla Shinawi, who presents a cycling podcast, Femina, with me. And a reminder that the latest episode came out this week, so have a look for that. Francois Thomaso joined us at the Tour de France, which was great fun and a great honour to have a doyen of the press room, Francois, have him on the podcast. And he'll be joining us on the podcast again at the Tour next year. Fran Reyes joined us at the Vuelta. Thank you to him. Ciro Scogna Emilio popped up and shot off again throughout the year. Thank you to Ciro. Seb Piquet, a regular on the podcast. And Hannah Troop has been very helpful as well. Producers, Daniel.
Well, Daniel, sounds like Daniel's doing his sweet potato fries. I wouldn't want to stand between him and his dinner. So I'll thank all of our production team, without whom we would not be on the air. And in alphabetical order, in the spirit of egalitarian equality, Alex Adey, Adam Bowie, Matt Field, Mariana DeForge, Will Jones, John Mooney, Paul Scoins, and Tom Wally, who all bring something to the podcast and iron out all of our mistakes.
Well, not quite all of our mistakes,
probably better than we are.
We like to keep a few in, don't we?
Well, no.
we do. Thanks also to Nick Christian for doing our weekly newsletter. If you've not signed up for that, thecyclingpodcast.com. He writes a very entertaining and witty weekly newsletter. Thanks to Nick. Thanks to Simon Gill, who does our photography. Jonathan Rowe, director of podcasting, he's down as here. I think that's fair. He does pretty much everything other than actually podcasting. But thanks to Jonathan, he's a great help, especially with Friends of the Podcast. And if any of you have got technical problems, he's the guy that helps and does so very efficiently and well.
Also works on Christmas Day.
He just works all the time.
So if anyone's got problems with the podcast on Christmas Day, give Jonathan a call.
Yeah.
He'll be very...
And throughout the night.
He'll love that.
Thanks to David Luxton, who's our agent, and his colleagues at David Luxton Associates, Rebecca Winfield and Nick Walters.
And a big thanks to the people who provide our music. Depending on which episode you're listening to, the music is either by Glass Pear or 13 Senses or the fantastic Amalaterra. They provided the music for our Giro episodes. Santeray are the sound of the Tour de France, and Mas y Mas are the sound of the Vuelta. And also, of course, the hosts of our podcast, if you like, Audio Boom, and that's the company that basically hosts all of the audio files and makes sure that when you want to listen to an episode, you're able to do so. And big thanks to Ruth Fitzsimmons and all of the people at Audio Boom. Just one little note of business for anyone out there who's listening on SoundCloud, which is another podcast audio delivery system. Unfortunately, from the end of this year, we will no longer be posting our episodes on SoundCloud. So if you use SoundCloud, there are loads of different places that you can listen to the podcast. If you check out thecyclingpodcast.com, I think there's a list of the places that you can listen to us. And if the reason you use SoundCloud is because you like to download an actual file onto your desktop or what have you, don't worry, because you'll be able to do that from our website from the start of January.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for those thank yous, Lionel. Hope you enjoy your sweet potatoes, Daniel. And I think we should sign off and sing the episode out. What do you reckon?
Sing?
No, I'm joking. Of course we're not going to do that. No, thank you very much, Lionel. Have a very Merry Christmas and happy new year when it comes.
Thank you very much, Richard. I do hope you manage to source a turkey before the big day. I mean, I sent you that picture.
Well,
sent you that picture, yeah, of Iceland's turkey slices in gravy. I do hope that you don't end up with that on Christmas Day.
Well, last year I got one on Christmas Eve in M&S, but last year was a little bit different. It was an emergency situation. This year we do have a plan B, and that is goose. So don't worry about us; we'll be fine. The father-in-law,
so disgustingly posh.
The father-in-law went and rang the neck of a goose in their garden recently, and we'll be bringing it over. So don't worry, and we'll be enjoying some of that type of food when we land at their house at the Tour de France in July next year.
Yeah, that was one of the best things about the tour route, was the fact that Amiens will be on the route, and means that we'll be able to stop off at your in-laws, where you're absolutely right. We had a goose from the garden, and it was delicious. Yeah,
plenty more where that came from. And thank you, Daniel. Have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
You too, chaps.
Oh, he's too busy with his low GI.
Well, and then fries, vegetarian sausages. Anyway, vegetarian bratwurst, actually. Dear. Anyway.
Oh, dear. Almost pointless eating those.
Right, on that note, thank you very much to everybody who's listened to the podcast this year. And we'll see you on the other side in 2018. Final word from me for 2017. I mentioned Hayden Grove's book earlier on, and I said I'd give you details about how to get it. It's called Back in the Saddle, Hayden Grove's. It's a magnificent looking silver covered book, huge, with beautiful photographs, nice words, and lovely recipes, as we discovered when we cooked a few of them when we had Hayden round for dinner. As I said, the money all goes to cure leukemia, 100% of the proceeds. The book costs £30, and you can get it at 3tourschallenge.com. 3tourschallenge.com. Go and check it out there, and do buy it if you fancy trying some of these beautiful recipes from France, Spain, and Italy.